When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to another Monday morning brought to you by Bo and Maisie.
Oh, I thought you were going to say like Coca-Cola or something. I was like, no. Dude, we're still not sponsored by them. Hello, losers. Get in. We're going podcasting.
Love it. I love that one.
If you don't get the reference,
get a life.
You don't. Well, yeah, there. That's it. I was going to say, if you don't get the reference, you don't get to podcast with us.
That's unfortunate as well.
But also, it's not true. You can stay, but just get better taste in movies.
Just be better.
Yeah. Get well soon, you know?
That's all we can say is just be better.
Yeah. And you know, you definitely need to be better.
Ugh, yikes. Why? What do I do?
Oh, where to start? I mean, I really could go on and on, but for right now, I'm just going to do, I'm just going to take like 8 seconds, maybe.
Oh, to do what?
I just to apologize for some things on your behalf. So first of all, I really feel, it's really been laid on my heart recently, that.
Thank God I'm you're just, not dramatic. Jeez.
I'm just,
what could I have possibly done in this episode?
Well, you know, I just really feel like we need to apologize for the fact that Maddie not only did a whole episode on a body of water, but also that she made it so gross and gruesome.
Yeah.
Also, for the whole, you know, this one's so emotional.
Mm.
This was obviously a big mistake on Maddie's part.
Okay.
But I'm going to be the one apologizing for it because she can't.
Mm. Yikes.
Stand up.
Is that what we're saying now?
Yeah, she can't accept responsibility for what she's done.
Yikes.
So unfortunately, I have to do that, and I have to take the fall for it. But the whole sink or swim debacle, how she could not say that. It was swim or sink, but she couldn't even say that either.
It was hard for me. It was hard for her.
It was very hard for her.
Yeah.
So maybe we should have a moment of silence.
Sink or swim.
Okay, moment of silence over.
Good.
That was a very long moment.
It was a long moment.
I hope you had some time to reflect on the choices you've made.
I absolutely did not.
Okay. I didn't expect you to.
No changes will be made in my behavior.
Okay. All right, we're canceling Maddie. So.
Yeah, duh, you forgot about that. Come on.
Well, we'll see what happens. Maybe they'll still cancel you. But otherwise, how are you doing today?
Bo. Hush. It's okay. Shh. It's okay, baby. They're gone. Someone was like walking in their house. They were loud.
Yeah, I know. And I was really hoping you would get Bo to be quiet because I've learned from past experiences that when you want to eavesdrop on people, the mics pick it up better than your ears do.
No way.
So I'll just turn it way up.
We love to see that.
And, yeah. Lauren and I used to do that in our dorm because people
should see the levels on my recording right now. It's just like a straight line top to bottom after Bo's bark.
Like, Lauren and I would sit in our dorm and do that. And, like, anytime we would hear someone talking in the hallway because people would, like, spill the tea.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, it was college. So we would just, anytime we'd hear people outside when we were recording, we'd just, like, turn that off all the way up.
Just crank it. Thanks, Bo.
Thank you.
Appreciated that one.
So how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I guess I can say this on the air. I'm fully vaccinated now, which is exciting.
You're doing good? What good are you doing?
Being fully vaccinated? Okay, does that not count as good?
I'll allow it.
That
I was trying to make
today.
Fun of your grammar, but that is doing good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where I'm at. I just feel like I did a good thing today, so kind of on cloud nine.
Okay. You want to do another good thing today?
Yes. What is that?
Listening to me.
Yes.
So I'm just going to bring it way down after you bring your mic up.
Oh.
Going to bring it way down.
Like the mood? Like, are you about to kill the mood?
Yeah.
Oh, yikes. All right, go.
Or we could just bring the lights down and really bring up the mood. You know what I'm saying?
No.
Make it cozy?
Let's just make it happen.
Okay.
Tell me what it is. What do I need to know?
Okay. So I want you to picture a young family's perfect home.
Okay. Oh, this will be easy. I love bringing my personal trauma onto the podcast so everyone feels uncomfortable.
I felt uncomfortable.
I'll cut that out.
No, please leave it. And that was I just didn't know what to do because I was like, do I go straight into what I'm going to say next? Because it feels wrong. But it also feels wrong to just let you have that because it totally feels like a like cry for help.
No, I'm good. Mm-hmm. All right. So I'm going to close my eyes.
Close your eyes.
Okay.
Picture the young family in a perfect home. These are the Judsons. The father, Robert.
The Jetsons?
Judson. J-U-D-S-O-N.
I just thought the Jetsons were more fun, but...
Oh, boy. Okay. We're going to keep going with this before she says something out of turn. The Judson family. Yes. The father, Robert.
Okay.
The mother, Kate. And the baby, Linda May.
That's a pretty name.
They're living the American dream.
Mm.
In a beautiful house with a big front porch.
White picket fence, I imagine.
Sure. But inside, there is nothing but chaos and destruction.
Mm.
Robert and Kate lie dead in the bedroom.
Oh, God.
Kate on the bed. Robert on the floor.
Oh, boy.
Bloody footprints leading up to them. There's a pool of blood in the baby's room.
Mm.
And spattered on the wall behind her crib.
No.
Untouched by investigators, the scene has been frozen in time.
What?
You may open your eyes. How you feeling?
Uneasy.
That was like reverse meditation.
I didn't like it. I can feel my heart rate increase rapidly.
Okay.
I would like to first off know the fate of the baby. I would also then...
No one survived.
I don't know how to react right now. This is one of those moments where I don't know if it's appropriate to add in humor as like comedic relief because this is depressing or if it's completely frowned upon because it's distasteful. I'm a little stumped.
Do you have a joke?
Well, I was going to say part of me pictured Harry Potter when you first said that.
Oh,
you
know yeah, but saying? No, the baby did not survive.
Okay. So yes, that was going to be my comedic relief. Wasn't that funny? And thanks now I just sound insensitive to people's trauma.
Well, we're going to move on. Well, actually, we're going to move backwards.
Oh, gosh.
We're going to way rewind.
Okay, rewinding. So Robert, Kate, Linda May, as of now, are dead.
Yes, they are.
Okay.
But we're going way back.
Okay.
Frances Glessner Lee was born on March 25th, 1878.
Oh, this is way back.
Yeah.
Hey-o. Okay.
Snow, yes. As a child, she was sometimes known as Fanny.
Okay.
And she grew up as an upper-class socialite in Chicago in the Gilded Age.
I'm sorry. Quick, I hate the Gilded Age. I remember having to learn it in A-Push, and I literally wanted to... I guess I can't make that joke because people have died already in this episode, but you get the point.
Literally all of A Push is a blur. Don't remember any of it. It was my first period.
Mm, like, that's unfortunate.
It was literally 7:38 a.m. We're not going there.
All right, so Franny, Gilded Age.
Fanny.
Yes. Yikes.
Frances.
Fanny. Okay.
Her father, John Jacob Glessner, made a fortune with International Harvester.
Okay.
Just a little bit of how that happened. In the early 1850s, an agricultural machinery manufacturing company was founded known as Warder, Brokaw, and Child Company. Glessner began working for them in 1856, and the company was later reorganized and renamed Warder, Bushnell, and Glessner Company.
Got it. Okay.
He was part of
He's now part of it.
Yep. He moved to Chicago to open a branch office for the company, which was later merged with a few other firms to become International Harvester. He became vice president of the company and made his fortune through growing International Harvester, really being there from the beginning, working his way through the ranks and all that. So he's got quite a bit of money.
Got it.
Fanny's mother, also named Frances, but Frances M. Glessner, was a bit of a stereotypical upper-class mother. She oversaw the beautiful and expensive and expansive house and fulfilled a much more domestic role than her husband. Fanny was known to be somewhat of a sheltered child and perhaps a bit spoiled.
Mm.
She and her brother were both educated at home, and Frances also learned the typical... And Frances also learned the typical skills of a wealthy woman. I can't say the sentence. We're going to do it. Frances also learned the typical... Maisie. She just like headbutted that.
I can't even... Oh, there she is. Maisie. I couldn't even see her for a second.
Maisie, settle.
I got to readjust real quick.
Settle.
All right. I'm ready.
All right. See if I can do the sentence.
Okay.
Where was I?
Okay. Frances.
Yep. Frances also learned the typical skills of a wealthy woman in that time, such as sewing, embroidery, painting, interior design, and making miniatures, like dollhouses, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That was quite big in the time. Her brother went on to attend Harvard, and there are accounts that Frances wanted to go to law school or medical school, but her parents believed that it was improper for a woman to do so.
Well, of course, because why could a woman go to law school and argue and use logic and reason to do anything?
In the late 1800s, no reason for that. So instead, Frances got married to a young, up-and-coming attorney named Blewett Lee, I think. I kind of thought he had a third name, but I guess it's just Blewett Lee is all I wrote, which doesn't feel like a real name to me, but that's what I wrote. So
that seems like a Jay Gatsby kind of situation.
Yeah. And she was only 19 years old when she got married.
Yeah, go off, sis. Actually, go off and get rid of that man and go to law school, but whatever. You do it too.
That would have been nice.
Hmm.
Sad. During their marriage, they had three children.
Okay.
And seemed to be going well for a while, but eventually they did separate and ultimately got a divorce.
Mm.
And it does seem that by now, by this point in her life, Frances was fairly frustrated with her lot in life.
Yeah.
Not necessarily like that she was born into a wealthy family. She did seem to be like appreciative and understanding of that, but rather with the limits of her family and her
gender?
Social standing as a woman. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Got it.
Her son actually said that he believed that part of the reason their marriage did fall apart, like the reason it didn't work out, was due to her, quote, creative urge coupled with high manual dexterity, the desire to make things, which Lee did not share, like her husband. Yeah. So it seems like maybe, you know, she was not necessarily built for domestic life. She wanted to make things. She wanted to be doing things. She was very creative. And her husband wasn't a fan.
We stand Franny.
Fanny.
Yikes, why do I keep calling her Franny?
Because her name is Frances.
We stand Frances, a.k.a. Fanny.
Yeah, Maisie somehow got a Nerf bullet. No idea where that came from.
Well, that definitely shows that she's your dog, because I do not own a Nerf gun. Nor have I ever. Nor will I ever. I know it's Nerf or nothing, but...
Nothing. It's nothing. And you know what? You know what? So are you. You're nothing to me. So around the 1930s, Frances, now divorced, was now free from the marriage that left her feeling stifled. And around the same time, she also inherited her father's fortune.
We'd love that. Absolutely love that.
With less expectations, more time, and more money, she could now explore some of the things that she was most interested in, that she did not have the ability to do so before. One of these things that she was very interested in was crime.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously solving crime, not committing crime, correct? Are we unsure? Is it both?
No comment.
I wanted you to say something funny.
Oh, like, okay.
No, that's fine. Mom's gone. She ruined it. That's fine.
So crime. All right.
We record better at night. That's all I'm saying.
We do not.
The night episodes are always the one that are like an hour long.
Yeah. And the morning ones are always good and sharp and clean.
And they're like 30
and funny
minutes.
And funny. And then
these are hilarious. What are you talking about? Are you kidding me?
No, they're
we can't
hilarious.
Make it through a sentence without laughing.
They're hilarious, but they're a different kind of hilarious. Like they are pure chaos
and ADHD.
Right.
And we cannot stick to any thought. It's a different kind of funny.
I don't even have ADHD, y'all.
She's just feeding off of mine and feeding into mine.
You're welcome.
So, again, I say.
Crime.
So crime.
So crime.
So she had always had an interest in forensics, but a few years earlier she had, like a few years before getting this mm-hmm. money and freedom and all that, she had started spending time with her brother's classmate, George Burgess McGrath.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll say that. He later became a professor of pathology at Harvard Medical School and became the chief medical examiner of Suffolk County.
Wow.
So she learned a lot about the holes in the investigative process.
Hmm.
For example, that coroners were not required to be doctors with medical degrees. They still aren't.
What?
Yeah, they're not.
I did not know that.
So coroners don't have to have medical degrees in most places. Medical examiners do.
Got it.
A coroner is like an elected official.
Okay.
And the medical examiner is appointed.
Got it.
Coroners mostly do like signing death certificates and overseeing stuff. Yeah, but at the time, they weren't necessarily as separated as they are today. Like, that's what it is today.
Yeah.
But back in those days, forensics.
Forensics.
How do I put this?
You don't.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it was starting to be the thing, but
not quite there.
Yeah. They were doing good things considering
right.
how little had been done in the past. But
we'll give them some cred.
In comparison to today,
I would
not want them to be investigating my murder.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I think that's a great way to put it.
And some other holes in the investigative process being that many police and detectives were not properly trained. And so with the help of her friend, she began learning more and more about the fledgling field of forensic investigation.
Quite an alliteration you just had there.
I didn't mean to do that. I didn't notice it until I was like about to say forensic. I was like, well, we're already here.
Mm-hmm.
So together, her and her friend, who was her brother's classmate, they lobbied to have coroners replaced with trained medical professionals and medical examiners, or to at least have one present. She also endowed the Harvard Department of Legal Medicine, which was the first of its kind in America.
Hmm.
And even more gifts to Harvard established the George Burgess McGrath Library, a chair in legal medicine at Harvard, and the Harvard Seminars on the Harvard Seminars in Homicide Investigation. Love it.
Wow.
Just love it. And additionally, she had endowed the Harvard Associates in Police Science, which is a national organization which aims to further forensic science. And this organization had a division dedicated to her that was named the Francis Glessner Lee Homicide School, which is just one of the coolest things I've ever heard. And if I ever get my name on anything, I want it to be something like that.
So she kind of like built the Harvard forensics.
Kind of. She certainly...
she's like kind of one in the same, you might say.
She certainly helped.
Yeah.
She certainly grew it quite a bit. Because she had money to put towards it.
There you go.
But back to the Harvard seminars in homicide investigation. These seminars would usually include 30 to 40 men. And as the only woman in attendance, it was Frances who would preside over these seminars.
Hmm.
Interestingly, this is where we see her nature of interest in forensics collide with her nurture of like trained domesticity, or the first time we see it anyway. As she would like hold big banquets at the Ritz-Carlton, and she would plan out fancy table settings and floral arrangements and ensure elaborate evenings that included lavish food for the detectives and the medical examiners that were in attendance.
So she just kind of blended what was traditionally expected and almost said like, look, I can do both.
Yeah, pretty much.
I like it.
Yeah, it's good stuff. After years of interest in forensics and surrounding herself with investigators and professionals, she was finally able to somewhat break into this male-dominated field that she really did not have any education in before this. And she obviously did get some informal education in a lot of this and attended these seminars and things like that. But, you know, no degrees or anything like that. But this is not what she was famous for. She became famous for what the Smithsonian calls murder is her hobby.
Mm.
That sounds like you. I'm just kidding. Solving murders on it? Okay.
What?
I guess it'd be like solving murders. You like to do that in your free time?
Me?
Yeah, like criminology stuff. Like
you I haven't solved any murders.
Well, I guess whatever.
That I know.
Researching them, learning about them.
Yes, I suppose. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, but she, am I understanding this, that she is not going to be the one that's solving murders? Is she the one committing the murders?
What do you think?
I think she's committing them.
Well, the thing is, the murder that I described was not actually a murder. In fact, it was not even people. It was no living being. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
Okay.
So what she was famous for was what is right. titled Murder is Her Hobby. And it was not all of her time and money and passion that she dedicated to forensic investigation that earned her title of the mother of forensic science, also sometimes the godmother of forensic science.
Okay.
She wanted to do more than what she was doing. She wanted to do more than just donating money and having banquets and things like that. But obviously she was limited by gender stereotypes and social limitations. So Glessner Lee realized that students needed to learn how to properly investigate a crime scene. But that in doing so, they would disturb evidence and make vital mistakes that could ruin real investigations until they were properly trained. But in order to be properly trained, they actually had to attend these things.
Right.
So there was kind of that vicious cycle going on. She also believed criminological theory, that scientific analysis of both material and visual evidence could solve crimes. Seems, you know, pretty reasonable now.
Right.
So again, she combined her true passion with her trained femininity, this time to create dollhouses.
Oh.
But these were not any ordinary dollhouses.
I'm seeing this.
Yeah. These were dioramas that she named The Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death.
Huh.
These 19 dioramas display scaled-down composites of real crime scenes in incredible detail. So they are, you know, kind of based on real
events.
Real, yeah, like true cases, but it's not like this one is this specific case. It's, it's a composite of multiple cases, generally. But really incredible detail.
That's so cool.
So the scale is, I think, like an inch to a foot. Soup cans are labeled correctly.
Wow.
Blood spatters are completely realistic in their patterns. They are not like pared down dollhouse lives like most dollhouses are. They're just scaled down. They're not pared down at all. They are like real full lives of people, and they are just frozen in time. Calendars are correct of like when people were murdered, like what, you know, what calendar page did they have open. Household items are perfectly arranged. Minuscule mouse traps actually work.
Wow.
The doors and the locks work. They lock and unlock with the keys that she made that are,
oh my gosh,
pick up with like a tweezers. It's absolutely insane. And Glessner Lee completely obsessed over these details, and she spent about $3,000 to $4,500 on each diorama. And I don't know if that is adjusted for inflation or not. I could not find that information anywhere. I checked multiple sources.
Either way, it's a lot of freaking money on a dollhouse.
Yeah, and she made 19 of them.
Holy guacamole.
And they took a long time because, again, she obsessed over detail.
Imagine Harvard coming to her and saying, hey, we need a little more money to do this cool new program. She's like, can't, sorry, building my 18th out of 19 dollhouses. And they're like, what?
Love it, love
it. And then she brings them to the lecture hall and says, boom. And they're like, what?
Get with it, boys. Although many of them do depict female victims in a domestic setting, which was perhaps, you know, her own way of getting out some frustration and talking about the dangers of extremely stereotypical and like forced roles. They do depict an array of lifestyles and victims. There's a lot of like middle class families, but there's also things like seedy rented rooms that the disenfranchised may have been living in, and, you know, depictions of sex workers and things like that, of like people who have died in all kinds of circumstances.
Wow.
But a lot of these scenes are things that Glessner Lee never would have found herself in real life.
Yeah.
Which I do think that a lot of those things of like putting herself in the shoes and the crime scenes of people that she would not come in contact with was not something that most socialites did in the Gilded Age or post-Gilded Age. You know, we're getting more 1930s, 1940s now, so, you know.
Yeah.
But she grew up in that, and that's a lot. And in order to make these accurate, Glessner Lee did many things that most women of the time were not allowed to do, or perhaps would not want to do, or both. Mm. She sat in on autopsies, and she walked through real crime scenes and spent time with experts in her field. She studied blood spatter patterns and so on. She even ensured that the dolls' corpses had accurate discoloration and bloating to when... how bloated was this corpse when it was found? Crazy. I don't know how you put bloat on a doll, but somehow she managed to do it. But the thing is, these aren't really whodunits. It's rather, given what we have, how do we do it?
Mm.
Not what has been done, but what will we do?
Oh, I like, that's interesting.
So the point isn't necessarily to solve the crimes in these dioramas, but to train yourself.
Right. As in, if you're the investigator, what are you going to do in this situation? Exactly.
The point is to train your eye to notice what's important in a visual information, and to train students how to collect detail and think critically in an overwhelming situation.
Mm-hmm.
Figuring out the manner and the cause of death only happens when all of this has been done properly.
Yeah.
You aren't going to walk in and know what happened. You know, and if you aren't trained properly to know what to look for, you're going to get overwhelmed when you walk in, overwhelmed or misled, and not know where to start and just be like, there's a bunch of stuff here and there's a dead doll over there. I don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
Where do I start? So that's the point of these dioramas, is to train students. But these miniatures do train one to go about it very methodically. And she had a certain way that she suggested be done, but, you know, everyone has a different method. I think hers was kind of like going like a clockwise spiral. So it's kind of like you just have a pattern to follow.
Yeah.
So you're not getting pulled away in a bunch of different directions. Yeah, exactly. And in fact, there are no public answers. Like, you can look at pictures of these, but there are no public answers of like, what happened here? Was this a suicide? Was this homicide? Was it an accident? Was it natural causes? There's no answers publicly. There is a set of answers, but it is kept under lock and key. And I think maybe they sometimes use it for like actual students, but
interesting. And so are these public. So are these boxes, are they at the Smithsonian or are they kept in Harvard?
They were briefly there.
Okay.
So in 1945, Glessner Lee donated these dioramas to Harvard.
Got it.
To be used in her seminars that she was presiding over, which is awesome.
She's so cool.
She's just having these seminars and then she's like, hey, look at this absolutely groundbreaking dollhouse. Amazing. Love her.
I just did this in my free time. What are you doing? Yeah. What's your hobby?
So then in 1966, they were given to the Maryland Medical Examiner's Office. I believe that was when the seminars ceased.
Gotcha.
She was pretty old at that point. So Bruce Goldfarb, great last name, who works at the office of the chief medical examiner in Baltimore and oversees the collection, said, quote, "They do something that no other medium can do. You can't do it with film. You really couldn't do it with still images. Even today, I don't think there's a computer simulation that does what the nutshells can do." She knew that she was dealing with hard-boiled homicide detectives, so there couldn't be anything remotely doll-like about them. They were not toys.
Yeah.
So these were so complex and so convincing that they are actually still used for training and seminars on criminal investigations. Yeah, like 90 years later, almost 90 years later.
Wow.
But for, and that's for forensics, that's insane.
Yeah, seriously. Because so much has changed since.
Absolutely insane.
Even then the 70s and 80s.
Even since the 2000s.
Yeah.
Crazy how much has changed. But for a short while, they were on display at the Smithsonian American Art Museum's Renwick Gallery in Washington, D.C. And curator Nora Atkinson points out something interesting, which is that when people come in, they're given a flashlight, a little flashlight to investigate these miniature crime scenes. But she points out that they would often come in thinking that they'd be able to solve the cases by looking at these dollhouses. But people would just leave with no idea of where to start.
Yeah.
But with a better idea of just how insanely complicated real crime scenes are.
Yeah.
This is a completely random fact that I don't know why I didn't say it earlier, probably just because I completely forgot. But as a child, Frances was really into Sherlock Holmes. as well. Interesting. You know, when you have an interest in forensics,
yeah,
criminology, whatever it may be, you're gonna
like Sherlock.
You're gonna like Sherlock. But that did actually kind of inspire her in these in a way, because it partially inspired her attention to detail, because in a lot of the Sherlock Holmes stories, the crimes that go unsolved, at least, you know, before Sherlock comes in, are because of lack of attention to detail.
Yeah.
And that is very much what she is trying to get across
in these miniatures. Sherlock comes in, he's like, did you see this one piece of wood that's out of place? And investigators are like, what the heck? We totally didn't see that, Sherlock.
Thanks, man.
You're welcome.
That I'm not going to be able to take out.
No.
Well, you know what? I obviously can't do anything about this because my dog has got the zoomies and is repeatedly, chucking her toy around and figurating it because of the canine instinct to break an animal's neck. And you know what? There's nothing I can do about it. So you're just going to hear her crinkling toy in the background. And we're going to finish it up with that. And deal with it. So because of how important her work was, it's just so distracting. It's how...
Maisie.
Lay down. Good girl. So because of how important her work was and still is, Glessner Lee was made an honorary captain of the New Hampshire State Police.
Wow.
Yeah, the Go state off, police. And as such, she was the first woman ever to join the International Association of Chiefs of Police.
Well, how about that?
She's just got like...
A woman with no education.
She did so much stuff.
Yeah, she definitely is a renaissance woman, I might say.
Her parents were like, you know what? How about you don't study those things? And she was like, that's fine. I'll still do everything that I would if I had a degree in it.
I'll show you.
And you know what? Who needs
college?
I will change the path of forensics forever.
Boom.
Suck it. Mom and dad.
Sorry, mom and dad.
I don't think she was.
This is where I should pull out the quote, don't ever let anyone dull your sparkle.
Oh.
Have you ever heard that one?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just felt like it was right.
I just really thought I would never have to hear it again, ever.
Sorry. I'm sorry. Just felt right. Well, Fanny's pretty great.
I don't want to talk to you. Mm. So to close us out, I say to the listeners, a quote from our lovely Sir Goldfarb. I don't remember his first name, so I'm going to call him Sir Goldfarb. Quote, she made forensic investigation into a scientific process. And you know what? That is extremely important. It seems like a simple thing to just like walk around, collect evidence properly. But at that point, to take something from guesswork and theories much of the time to scientific process and scientific evidence and all of that was absolutely groundbreaking. So she is just an absolute girl boss.
Yep.
Of the highest order in the best sense.
We love her. She's doing impeccable things.
Hi, baby. Oh my gosh. This dog is almost as needy as I am. I guess that's what happens when I train her. So with all of that being said about Francis Glessner Lee, my absolute hero, it is now time for me to go be my dog's hero and play with her.
Seriously. So here's where you can find this.
She has torn it apart.
For more.
Well, you know what? The other thing I want to say is there are some awesome pictures of these. It's not the same as seeing them in person, obviously, because there's so much detail. Mm-hmm. But maybe I'll send one to you and you can see what you can figure out.
That'd be great.
About this, and then we can compare notes. Maybe we'll definitely put the pictures online and all of that on the Instagram, and we'll see about the Twitter. I'm trying to use Twitter, but I hate Twitter. And then maybe we can all compare notes on a live or something, or send us an email of what you think happened in one of these scenes, because they're so fascinating and I could look at them for hours. They're a little spooky because they're old dollhouses that depict murder scenes. But it's lovely. She's lovely. I want to be her. So where can they find these pictures and contact us and see everything that we're doing? Because we are obviously the center of the universe and they want to know everything about what we were doing 24/7.
They can find us on Instagram and TikTok.
Hyperfocus Pod.
Twitter.
Hyperfocus_Pod.
YouTube and Facebook.
Goodness, Macy. I'd be surprised if you can hear this over my dog, but that is Hyperfocus, colon, a podcast for chaotic minds. She just threw that thing like 10 feet up into the air, and I saw it out of the corner of my eye only, and I tried very hard to get through the end of my sentence.
You did a great job. They can also find us at our email.
HyperfocusCast@gmail.com.
And with that, we will say adieu.
Stay chaotic, babes. Were you just making out with your pop filter? What's happening there?
Yes, that is the answer to that question.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.